Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is Carla Albridge. She is a humorist and award-winning singer-songwriter and the author of How Can You Not Laugh at a Time Like This? Carla and I will be discussing about her funny look at her personal life's journey and her new book, How Can You Not Laugh at a Time Like This? Good morning, Carla. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I am great. Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to talk with you about your book. It's a wonderful read, and although the subject matter is kind of serious, your humorous approach made it very inspiring and entertaining. It's packaged very well. Love the artwork up front. It's really funny.
Oh, thank you.
Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay, well, I'm from South Carolina. That's where I was born and raised. And I don't remember anything till age four. I think most people don't. Who wants to remember diapers and bottles anyways?
There you go.
At four, my aunt came to visit, and she had her guitar with her. And after she left, that's all I said. I want a guitar, I want a guitar, I want a guitar, I want a guitar. So I finally got a guitar. And my parents got the very subtle hint. And that was the beginning of music for me. Started guitar lessons. And I was always the kind of kid who loved humor. Looney Tunes, Sesame Street. Ernie and Bert are the funniest comedians I've ever seen. I think they're just hysterical still. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Seuss records and comic books. Always into humor, and I always used humor to dispel any difficult situations, anyone arguing or complaining. I always tried to be the family clown to cheer people up. I wasn't really like that, like the class clown, because I was a strange combination of a clown, but I was shy. I had sort of stage fright, performance anxiety. But if you ever saw the Looney Tunes cartoon of Michigan J. Frog, that was me. It was this frog who in private would sit there and just, hello, my baby, hello, my darling. And then as soon as he got up on the stage, he was like, ribbit. As soon as he got out in public, totally nothing. So as a kid, that was me. Very very funny behind closed doors and very, very quiet in public. So I was a music major. I did major in classical guitar, which made me even more performance anxiety. I think a music education is something that they should give you 4 years of therapy afterwards. Makes you afraid to play music. But one of the strangest, best and worst things to ever happen to me was to get sick at the age of 24, very shortly after getting out of college. I was working in retail, which is, wow, what a tough profession. It's so hard. And lots of rejection, lots of walking around in uncomfortable shoes on cement for 8 or 10 hours a day. And it's just a hard job. And it doesn't pay well either. I'm quite relieved to not be in that job anymore, which is why when I got fired for being sick, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me. I didn't think so at the time. I wasn't like, yay, thanks for firing me. But it was freeing because I really wanted to be singing my songs. I was writing songs by then. I had started writing in high school, but I never played them for anybody. I was still hiding them, at, you know, like Michigan J. Frog. They never left the house. Like my songs were agoraphobic or something. And then when I got fired for being sick, I just fell, you know, sicker and sicker and sicker. And finally, my parents had to come up and rescue me from myself and move me in to live on their couch for a few months while I got myself back together. But what happened was I finally, when I realized I was going to live, because I honestly didn't think I was going to live, I was 80 pounds, had no hair, and couldn't even eat some days, and I couldn't get out of a chair by myself. My kidneys were failing, and I was anemic. And then when I got turned around and realized, hey, I'm not going to die. Well, I'm not going to go back to the life I had before. I got a second chance now. I got a clean slate. This is another chance to put my life together on purpose instead of just by default. So that's what I did. I said, I'm going to pursue my dreams. And now that I had faced kidney failure, near death, stage fright just seemed kind of silly after all that. So I decided, okay, I'm going to work for myself. I'm going to sing my songs. I'm going to teach guitar lessons in my own studio. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've been doing ever since, working for myself.
Fantastic. Growing up, were your family fairly humorous people?
I would not say my sisters were all that humorous, but they appreciated my humor. I hope, because I was pelting them with it all the time. And my parents kind of had an appreciation for humor. Certainly, they're both very smart. They're both PhDs, and they appreciate humor. And my grandmother had a good sense of humor.
Yeah,
I got along better with my grandmother than anybody else because I could make her laugh.
Interesting. So why did you write How Can You Not Laugh at a Time Like This?
Well, this is the book I wish I had had 20 years ago when I got sick. Mm-hmm. And, of course, 20 years ago, you'll probably imagine there wasn't any internet. So
yeah.
If you wanted information about anything, including an illness, you had to go to the library or write letters and wait for an eternity for the return letter to come back to you. Mm-hmm. And I actually went to the library to find out what lupus was, because that's what I was finally diagnosed with after 2 years of going to the doctor. And I'd never heard of it. I didn't know what it was. So I went to the library, went to the encyclopedia, which is the absolute worst place to get health information because it's outdated.
Right.
And I left the library thinking I would be dead in 5 years.
Wow.
Because that was the case with lupus 4 years ago. They didn't have any way to treat it. So it was a death sentence. So for several months, I thought, oh, my life is over. This is it. I'll just sit around and wait to die. Which is why when I started getting better, it was so amazing that I realized, oh, I have who knows how many years. I'm not living the way I lived before. Oh, so why I wrote the book, I wanted to help other people because I would give talks once I got better and people had watched me go from a walking skeleton to somebody who was laughing and so alive and vibrant that they wanted to know, how on earth did you get better? What in the world did you do? Is this some kind of magic trick? What are you doing? And I would try to tell them everything I had done, all the alternative medicine and the diet changes and the lifestyle changes and the journaling and all that. And I, after they would finish talking to them, I'd always think, oh, I forgot to tell them this. So if I put it all in a book, I'll have lots of time to rewrite and remember to put it all in there. I won't forget anything.
The stories that you cover in the book were very serious, but yet you have written them in such a wonderful way with a great touch of humor. What makes this possible?
Well, Carol Burnett said that comedy is tragedy plus time.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to say that comedy is pain plus distance. So that way you don't have to wait for time to pass, because I want to laugh about it now. I don't want to have to wait 5 years to laugh about something. Nobody needs a laugh more than someone who's sick. It's, you know, laughter is so good for you. It lowers your blood pressure. It relaxes your muscles. It helps you sleep. So who needs laughter more than someone who's in a lot of pain and suffering? But that's when it's hardest to laugh. So I like to find a way to create distance so that I can laugh as soon as possible. And if I can't laugh about the situation, then give me a comic book and give me something else to laugh about. or a funny movie or something.
Right.
Or some Three's Company reruns. So, I forgot the question again. I get started. I'm like a wind-up toy with it. I'm like, you know what I am? I'm like those pair of teeth that you wind up and then they go gang, 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 gang.
The question basically is, how did this come about in terms of being able to take a tremendous amount of serious stuff and yet presenting it in a very wonderful way with a wonderful touch of humor? And I thought that was very interesting because your book come across to me as a guidebook. It's serious. It's a wonderful story about your personal experiences that you went through. you mentioned something that's very, very important just now at the very beginning, where you wish you have had the book when you were going through the situation, because it helps you in terms of having a totally different look at life going into encountering the things that you have encountered.
Yeah, when I did get some information, I got information, but I didn't get any hope. And that would people would tell me in great detail all the things that could go wrong with lupus. And then they would give you the two or three drugs that were available for lupus, and they were all horrible side effects. And I just, wow, I'm like, where's the hope? Can I, okay, you can keep me alive, but am I going to go crazy in the process?
The stuff that you have done in the book in terms of writing short formats, is there a reason why you wrote the book the way you presented it? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. There are a couple of reasons. One is I'm used to writing 3-minute songs. And that's a nice short form is what I've been doing for a very long time. So the idea of writing something that was 200 or 300 pages and having to have it make sense from the beginning to the end, that was overwhelming, because I'm not someone who's been writing books. I'm someone who's been writing songs, and then I had a story to tell, but it's a different form than what I'm used to writing. So I wrote this, I started this as a blog, and you would just start on a blog, okay, today we're going to talk about gluten sensitivity. And then you'd write a posting about gluten sensitivity and what it is and how you deal with it, and then you move to the next topic. So it helped me to write that way, and then it also, because I didn't really want to write a memoir where it's this big, long story and it's all about me. I kind of wanted to do something that it's about the reader. Like, we have this in common. Let me tell you how I dealt with it, and maybe it'll help you. And the other thing about the short chapters is you can pick it up in the middle of the book, read one chapter, put it down, jump to the end of the book, read one chapter. You don't have to go in order. Anything that grabs you, you can read that chapter. And also, if you're sick, it's really hard to hold your focus for 300 pages or 200, I don't know how many pages it is. So you don't have to. You can have ADHD and read this book. You can get interrupted and have to run to the bathroom, or you can read it in the bathroom. So the short chapters is just little vignettes. Pick it up, put it down, pick it up in the middle, jump around. Try to make it user-friendly.
You're right, because when reading it, you don't have to finish a whole lot of stuff, because you can go directly to the specific things that you want to read that kind of relate to you at that time as well. So it makes it very, very easy as far as that goes. Please share with us some of the strangest and funniest things that happened to you that you wrote in the book.
Well, at the worst point, you know, I've been sick with it 3 times, and the second time I had a stroke, and I had congestive heart failure, so your legs get all full of water and swollen, and my feet too. I could not wear shoes, so I had to wear slippers everywhere, indoors, outdoors, everywhere. And I was living with a couple in Florida, and their dog was always eating my slippers while I was wearing them. Now, the Florida, in the summer, every afternoon you get a thunderstorm. And I was either going to the doctor or the acupuncturist or the chelation therapist or somebody every single day. I had appointments almost every single day, you know, Monday through Friday. And then I would leave the office at 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and it would be pouring buckets. And I had a cane, and I had compression hose, which wearing full pantyhose in Florida when it's 100 degrees and 100% humidity. And I would have to walk to my car, and my shoes would turn into sponges, and they'd go all the way to the car. And I felt like, wow, I've got slippers, pantyhose, and a cheap wig. People don't know if I'm a bag lady or a cheap hooker. This is quite a look here. And then I was at a festival, and I had just stopped using my cane, probably prematurely, because I still didn't have very good balance. And we were standing around, me and a bunch of friends, and laughing. And I don't know if you've ever done this, but you're laughing and you sort of lean over to somebody like, hey, wasn't that funny? Well, right when I leaned over, my friend moved and I fell down and my wig fell off.
Oh, my God.
It was so embarrassing. And I couldn't get off the ground by myself. So my friends all helped me get up. And then because they showed concern, I was able to laugh about it right away. And I said, well, I have now literally laughed my head off. Because my wig fell off.
I mean, in hindsight, when you look at stuff like that, it gives you plenty of material to work with.
Absolutely. Because if comedy is pain plus distance, you have an endless source of the first half of pain between the disease and the humiliation and the doctors and the hospital. And yes, if you can figure out how to look at it from a different point of view, you will never run out of material.
One of the things that I got from reading your book is that the fact that you look at things from a different way, it kept you very uplifted.
Yes. And I'll tell you, I can't really take all the credit because I was pretty bummed out at different points.
Yeah.
I wasn't like I just, oh, I'm sick. That's hilarious.
I
was really depressed at different points, certainly when I left the library thinking that I'd be dead. I didn't find anything very funny for a few months there. And even though I was watching Looney Tunes every day, even that wasn't funny anymore. But my friend came to visit me, and she's one of the silliest, sweetest people I know. And she'd just bubbly, and we'd always had this rapport where either one of us was always trying to make the other one laugh. She came to visit me in the hospital, and she just jumped from topic to topic until she finally made me laugh. And next thing you know, I'm writing this song, because she got me laughing about grocery shopping. And the next thing you know, I'm writing this song, if you want me to pick up something next time that I go to the grocery store, put it on the list.
Right.
And I stayed up all night working on that, but she got me laughing again. She broke that and reminded me, hey, you know, you're still funny. You may be laying in the bed, but you still have a sense of humor. And
right.
And I have to give my friend Sarah Lynn, credit for reminding me that the sense of humor, the funny bone, was still intact.
Did you feel different when you started laughing and you realized that your entire body, the physical self itself, is just really absorbing all this wonderful energy?
Oh, absolutely. That was a huge turning point for me. And when I started doing that night and from then on was writing songs again, I wasn't really doing much of anything when I was sick, just trying to exist and survive. And I started writing songs and bringing my song idea notebook to all my doctor appointments, and it was a great distraction. And if anybody upset me, I'd write a song about them. Imagine there were a lot of songs about doctors. And it was just wonderful, and it helped me to create that distance. Even just the act of writing the songs about the things I was upset about gave me the distance that is required to be able to laugh about it, the whole pain plus distance thing. Even if it was happening right that moment, I write it down, and maybe the first draft wasn't funny. It'd just be me ranting and complaining. And then I'd figure out just getting it out would be kind of like detox. And then I'd be able to maybe a day or two later to find what was funny about it. But every day I was writing. I was just obsessed with writing about everything. That was my therapy.
Interesting. Well, let us listen to one of your songs. It's titled Sitting in the Waiting Room. And I thought this is really funny and is what you truly experience. And, of course, this is something that other people experience as well, but some people may not take it as being funny, but you did. And now it really put a new light into how you can perceive things in reality. And to me, that's wonderful.
Over and over, I make an appointment with you. Over and over, you're not sure what to do. Over and over, you refer me to somebody new. So over and over, I'm sitting in the waiting room. I'm at the rheumatologist, it's nephrologist.
writing is very lighthearted and yet it's serious, and you're able to put a wonderful twist to everything, and it just gets beneath the skin, so to speak. How has writing this kind of song and singing them contributed to your recovery?
Well, for one thing, it helped me. If I can run the doctor over in the song, I won't do it in real life. Helps me to vent my frustrations.
I can feel that. It's a transference for you. Do you feel afterwards that you were able to, like, really lift all this burden away from you?
I think so. It really feels like, for me, songwriting is a great way to get to say exactly what I meant to say.
Uh-huh.
Most of us have a hard time saying exactly what we mean to say
right.
in the way we mean to say it in the moment. But if you can go home with a rhyming dictionary and a thesaurus and all the time in the world, you can figure out exactly how to say what you meant to say in a way that people will get it and hear it.
And I'm most importantly, not offended by it, too.
Hopefully. Maybe. I don't know. People are funny how the things they'll be offended by. But for the most part, it's certainly not meant to be cruel. It's just an outlet for frustration. I think most people understand that. And any doctor who's had to go to a doctor understands
that. What were some of the other things that you have to go through? Because I knew that one of the things that you talk about, and obviously when you're severely ill, it's changing the diet, and you talk about having to eat gluten-free stuff and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that in terms of your diet, the changing of the diet, and how it affected you in some ways.
Well, I became willing to do anything to get better and to get off of the prednisone, which was driving me crazy and turning me into a crazy person, and also really bad insomnia and the long-term side effects. I did not want to even get anywhere near, because there are things like osteoporosis, diabetes, cataracts.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those things are entirely irreversible. I wanted to get off of the prednisone and not wind up 100 pounds overweight and blind and diabetic, as winding up with more problems than I started with. So I became extremely open-minded and willing to try anything. It's short of voodoo, but hey, if everything else failed, I probably would have tried voodoo too. And I did the gluten-free diet, which is difficult, and I'm still on the gluten-free diet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much better now. There are a lot more things available for gluten-free than there used to be,
including
gluten-free bread. Gluten, of course, is a protein that's found in wheat, barley, and rye.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cares too much about the barley and rye unless you're a beer drinker. But the wheat is a problem, because we're talking cake, cookies, donuts, crackers, bread, pizza, all the things that people in this country eat all the time. And when you go to a party, that's what's all over the table, pasta, pizza. You go to a corporate meeting, they're like, oh, we're going to have a pizza lunch. We have to work through lunch, so we'll bring in pizza. You're like, great, I'll be fasting. So it is challenging. You do have to think ahead and bring your own food. But to me, giving up gluten is difficult, but it's not as difficult as being on prednisone. And all the changes I made, which included getting acupuncture, and I do Qigong also every day, which only takes a few minutes, but I do it every morning. It's a lot like Tai Chi, deep breathing and slow movements and gentle healing that you can do yourself. It doesn't cost anything. And the gluten-free diet, which the only cost is inconvenience and hard to eat out.
Yeah.
And those kinds of things, you know, I don't have to fly to Lourdes and go into the bathing waters, but I do have to every day make these small choices that at first are challenging, but after you get used to them, it just becomes a habit. And those sorts of things made me able to get off of the prednisone. But I was so willing at one point, I would do anything. I did coffee enemas. I got all of my fillings pulled out because they have mercury in them. I got them all replaced with non-metal fillings. There was almost no extreme too far for me. I was really willing to try anything. I researched everything first and asked a number of people about it, not just jumping on the bandwagon, because you can't do everything. There's so many options out there that you have to pick your battles, and I did. But I am not on prednisone, thank heavens. I'm actually not on any drugs. At one point, I was on 9 drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I went completely crazy with my diet, being really careful, and I'm actually back to that right now, I was gluten-free and dairy-free, and I also gave up artificial sweeteners and MSG.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to get my lupus test to go completely negative. My blood test looked like somebody who'd never had lupus. So the choices we make every day do make a difference. They can be very powerful. Then I started eating all the stuff again, and the test went back to positive. So there's your scientific result right there.
You did a wonderful job in terms of, it's a guidebook for me. I think, you know, people don't realize that when you are in a situation where, oh my God, you went through it and you did this and you present it in a wonderful way and reminding us that you are who you eat, I guess, in some ways. And of course, you put it in a funny way.
I like junk food. Don't get me wrong, because I'd just soon be eating Doritos and Snicker bars and diet soda. I really enjoy those foods. But I also really enjoy being healthy. So
that's
a choice. For me, that was a choice. Some people can get away with eating more junk and not get sick, and it doesn't seem fair, but there's other things that happen to them that's not fair, too.
I try not to do things in excess. I think if you can balance it out as much as you could, and hopefully that will work out in itself. Were there at any time that you were going through this whole process, and we talked about this earlier in terms of you going through mood swings and being afraid of a lot of things, were there a scary moment whereby you were teetering on losing it all?
Sure. When I was down to 80 pounds and couldn't get out of the chair by myself and couldn't eat, I there was a moment where I knew I could consciously let go and I would have been gone. I would have died right on the spot.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a moment there where I had to make a conscious choice to stay on the planet. By then, I pretty much already lost it all. There was nothing really to stay on the Earth for as far as I could see at that moment. I'd already been fired for being sick. I didn't see myself ever getting better. I thought I was going to be dead in 5 years and in pain the whole 5 years waiting to die. And most of my friends had abandoned me because they didn't know how to help. They didn't see any hope. I pretty much had lost it all. Everything, the only thing was that I was just still breathing. So that was a dark moment.
But you were able to pull through, and I thought that was very interesting because you found some sort of inner strength empowered you to move forward. And you talk about that in your book in some ways. For example, it would be like the thing that you mentioned, which I thought was very interesting, was about clothing. It does not define you. Who is wearing the clothes that define you? Which in this case, you know, you knew better and who you are and so forth. And I guess maybe the fact that you look at life differently and you don't let anything on the outside to affect you, who you really are on the inside.
Well, I think trials and tribulations and challenges like being sick really do help you figure out who you are. You find out what you're made of. And there's a chapter in the book called Survivor, Kidney Island, talking about all those reality shows where you think in order to survive you have to stab people in the back and create these alliances and plot and scheme and blackmail and all that sort of thing. Well, those sort of things don't help you survive when you're sick.
Mm-hmm.
When it's you and the disease, you can't use those kind of tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And the traits of a survivor are quite different than what will help you survive on a reality show, which kind of makes it not so much a reality show.
Right.
They are things like having a sense of humor, you know, loving what you do for a living, what else? You know, a good sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, one thing that made me happy was, you know, you're kind of a pain in the neck to the doctors. I thought, okay, that's a good sign. I'm a survivor.
Yeah.
You know, having control of your life, being self-reliant and nonconformist. Looking for solutions, not getting bogged down in the problem, and not seeing your problems as a failure, which at first, when you get diagnosed with a chronic illness, especially as a young person, just as you're supposed to be leaving the nest and going out on your own and becoming independent, it feels like the biggest, like you just fell right on your face. It feels like a big failure.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to move past that because it just keeps you bogged down. So you just have to stay solution-oriented and just keep looking for solutions instead of just staring at the problem. And, you know, humor, of course, is a big survivor trait. community, spirituality. I remember reading in Bernie Siegel's book that a survivor is sometimes hostile. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to survive. And, you know, and a strong sense of reality. It's not denial. It's not the same.
Right.
Denial is not survival. You see the problem, but you also see the solution. There was another chapter in here about the lousy athlete, which is me. you know, just don't have a lot of athletic skills. I never did. And I'm mountain biking, and I keep falling off the mountain bike because I keep seeing things in the trail that I'm like, oh, I hope I don't run into that. And, of course, I'm staring at the thing that I'm going to run into, and I keep hitting it because that's what I'm staring at instead of staring at the part that's nice and smooth that I can ride right through. And then I go snow skiing, and same thing. There's a big snow machine at the bottom of the hill, and I'm thinking, oh, don't let me fall in front of that. Don't let me fall in front of that. Don't let me fall. And, of course, I fell right in front of it, and I got plastered in snow and ice because I was staring at what I was afraid of instead of looking at the entire rest of the ski slope. I could have just nicely, smoothly sailed right through the open spaces, but I was so focused on the problem. And that was when I realized, you know, I take everything as a metaphor because I'm a songwriter, so everything's a metaphor. But I thought about that, you know, after I finished laughing about the fact that my hat was frozen solid and my hair was a block of ice. You know, after I finished laughing about how ridiculous it was, because I wasn't really hurt, I was just embarrassed. Then I thought, you know, this is like life. You have to look where you want to go and not where you're afraid to end up.
You have a tremendous amount of mental power, though, because you read a lot during this time, and you also realized that the ultimate cure is not just outside. It's within our own self and up between our 2 ears, so to speak.
Absolutely. We all have a tremendous amount of mental power. And knowing that is like opening the door to just all kinds of potential wonderfulness. To know that we don't have to be passive victims and just go to the doctor and please fix me. All they have is drugs and surgery. That's all they can do for you at a regular doctor, you know, typical rheumatologist and so on. Those are the only tools they have. And drugs don't cure chronic illness. They just manage the symptoms. And surgery is its own ball of wax. And sometimes surgery is called for and it's the best thing, but when you wind up in a whole series of just drugs and then surgery to fix what the drugs did and then more drugs to fix what the surgery did, and it's this downward spiral. So we have to take control of the part that we do have control over, which is, of course, what we put in our mouth, what we think all day long. We can choose which thoughts we focus on, who we hang out with. Do we hang out with people who lift us up and help us laugh and care about us, or do we hang out with people who tear us down? And of course, we can find humor. If you can't find, if you're not the kind of person who can create the humor or find the humor yourself, Nickelodeon is running reruns of, you know, Laverne and Shirley and Three's Company all day long. I Love Lucy. There's always so much laughter out there available for us. So we do have a great amount of control, and we have to take the responsibility for the parts that we do have control over and to not be a passive and a victim. I never use the word victim on when I talk about, you know, some people use that language when you say, you know, stroke victim or lupus victim. I never use that word on myself because I don't want to be a victim. I don't see myself that way. And I have struggled, okay, what do I call myself, a survivor or, you know, some people use the word thriver. Mostly I just don't attach myself to the disease. I don't put the word lupus and myself in the sentence anymore than necessary, except when I'm going out and talking to other people who have lupus or another autoimmune disease and need to know, okay, Carla has lupus, so she understands. And she has some authority to talk about this. But in my daily life, none of my neighbors know I have lupus unless they're listening to Blog Talk Radio. I don't walk around wearing it on my chest.
Right.
I don't wear, you know, awareness ribbons. I try to make my difference. I have no problem with people wearing awareness ribbons, and everybody has to choose their own path and do what's right for them.
Right.
And I think it's great that people are out there creating awareness, because we have to counteract House MD, who is out there telling everyone it's never lupus. He's just like running a one-man anti-awareness campaign for this disease. He would never do that with any other disease. I don't know why that's funny. Why would you go, you know, it's never MS, it's never Parkinson's, it's never cancer.
Yeah.
Why is that funny? It's so insulting.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping they actually give somebody lupus on that, you know, not literally, but a character, write it into the show, you know, give House lupus. That would be great.
That would be a wonderful suggestion.
Hope they're listening.
How much support were you getting from your loved ones?
Well, when I first got sick, none, because I was very secretive about it, and I wasn't telling anybody what was going on, and I was living 4 hours away from my family.
Yeah.
And I was in a church, and unfortunately, this particular church, I'm not generalizing about churches, just this particular church I was in, some of the folks reacted very strangely and blamed me for my illness, said things to me like, oh, well, you were sick because you have a hidden sin in your life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I thought, okay, could you bring me a casserole? Because I'm not eating over here because I'm too tired to cook and I can't even get to the store because I can't turn my head, and you can't drive if you can't turn your head.
Mm-hmm.
So that I felt rather abandoned at that moment. I really, for about 6 months, had no support at all.
Mm-hmm.
And once my family understood how sick I was and what kind of condition I was in, they came up and got me and moved me back to my hometown and helped me out at that point.
Throughout your experience with the things that you have gone through, and of course got a lot of material from the things you experienced to give you the information that you need to poke fun on the miscues of being ill, as well as the healthcare system and so forth, the system in itself, were there experiences that you encounter that actually met and exceeded your expectation?
Yes. There were a couple of experiences that come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Once I was in the hospital, extremely upset because they had just told me they were going to give me transfusions, IV prednisone, so it's going to be extremely high dose of prednisone, and I already knew what prednisone did to me, turned me into a crazy person. And they were going to give me chemotherapy, which was going to make me sterile, and whatever hair I had left was definitely going to fall out now. So I was a little upset after getting all of this news, and not to mention I'm not too crazy about IV needles in the first place. And I was just lying there in the bed, just trying to process all this, so upset, just visibly upset and crying and thinking, I can't deal with all this. This is awful. And this woman came in, and I think she was an orderly,
mm-hmm.
not a nurse, not a doctor. She came in, and I think she was from Jamaica. She had a really nice accent. And she sat by the bed and sang to me. She held my hand and sang
mm-hmm.
me. I don't remember what she sang to me. And she was only there for maybe 5 minutes. It changed everything for me to know that this total stranger
mm-hmm.
just saw my pain and reached out to me and cared. Cared enough and got past whatever fear that we all have of sick people and strangers and other people's pain, and instead of running away, which is what most of us do,
mm-hmm.
came towards me. Even, you know, I watch way too much Law and Order because I still have insomnia. It's the one thing that puts me to sleep is Law and Order. I'm sure it's not very good for my psyche to be watching crime and then going to sleep. But the thing always in New York is like, oh, nobody saw anything because nobody wants to get involved.
Involved, right.
Yeah, well, she got involved, and she wasn't mm-hmm. related to me. I never saw her again. She didn't even tell me her name.
Yeah.
And to me, for all I know, she was an angel,
mm-hmm.
literally an angel, and just came down and said, no, somebody cares.
Right.
That was extraordinary to me. And this other moment that was extraordinary to me in a different way, which opened
mm-hmm.
my eyes to what doctors must go through, I had this doctor who only took Medicaid patients, and Medicaid pays almost nothing, just a little bit more than nothing, and you have
mm-hmm.
to get on the phone and argue with them to get that little bit more than nothing out of them. I didn't really know this or think about this until he told
mm-hmm.
me. But I went in, I'd seen him 3 or 4 times, and I came in for my appointment, and he said, well, how are you doing, Carla? And I said, you know, I'm fine. I still had all my problems. I still had neuropathy. I still had headaches. I still had diarrhea. I'm still using a cane. But nothing was new. All those things were the same as they had been 2 weeks before when I saw him. And I felt stable, and I no longer thought, oh, I'm not going to make it. I'm like, I'm going to make it. And by then I'm writing my songs, so I have a coping mechanism. And I have my friends. And but, you know, I'm fine. How are you, Dr. Chong? And he started crying. He started telling me all his problems and how Medicaid didn't want to pay him anything, and all of his patients were Medicaid. He only took Medicaid patients because he felt like he needed to give back because his medical education had been paid for entirely by grants. So he felt obligated, and he was under so much stress. And every test he ran, why did you run that test? You know, and every procedure, everything. And Medicaid patients are the sickest, poorest patients. In order to qualify for Medicaid, you have to be extremely sick and broke. So all of his patients are in the emergency room. They have terminal illnesses. They have serious illnesses. And he's telling me all this and just pouring his heart out to me. And I thought, oh, my gosh, there's a person under that wide lab coat. Wow, I had no idea how much stress they were under. And after that, every time I went to see him, he'd tell me all his problems. I should send him a bill.
See, now you're in charge of the situation.
I know.
By the way, it's time for us to listen to another song titled Prednisone. You've been talking a lot about it, and I thought this is really funny. And, of course, this is fast-forwarding, I would think, several years ahead, and it's really funny.
So last year I had a couple strokes and kidney failure, and all my hair fell out and grew back curly and dark. Now I can just go up to people who've known me for a long time. They have no idea who I am. Kind of missed my window of opportunity. I could have committed crimes all last year. And anyway, I wrote some interesting stuff during my recuperation, and I couldn't play guitar, so I wrote a lot of parodies. And this is a song I wrote. It's an ode to one of my medications. It goes like this. Thank you. More where that came from. Prednisone will make you get real fat. Prednisone will give you cataracts. Prednisone, it will destroy your bones. So take some prednisone, destroy your bones today. Prednisone, your moods are up and down. Prednisone, your face is big and round. Prednisone, we'll mess with your hormones. So take some prednisone, spend your life alone today. Give it to your cat, give it to your dog, give it to your guinea pig. See him acting weird, see him eat a lot, see him getting really big. Take it for your gout, or if you got a bout, a poison or a poison IV. Take it in a drop, take it in a pill, take it intravenously. Prednisone, you start with one complaint. Prednisone, now you've got seven or eight. Prednisone, you could be dead, you know. So pick your prednisone, or pick your tombstone today.
Now, you did that live.
Yes.
And that's fantastic. Is it even funnier looking back?
Well, it's always funnier looking back than living through it, for sure. I actually had an MD say to me that was the most medically accurate song they'd ever heard. So for me, I love sharing this with other people who have been through the same thing, and that's what makes it really fun to have these things at the time, which were so painful, to be able to go out and laugh about it and to help other people who are going through it now to be able to laugh about it. And so far, no one's ever come up to me and said, that's not funny. They usually come up to me and go, that's so true.
What would you like your readers to gain from reading How Can You Not Laugh at a Time Like This?
Well, I'm hoping they gain some ideas for things to try in order to improve their health. I'm really hoping that they get hope, to know that there is hope and that a lot of things are within their control. And most of all, I hope they get, well, also some laughs. I hope they get some entertainment value and some laughs out of the book. But most of all, I hope that they learn what I learned, which is to take your health seriously and yourself lightly. Again, I had that backwards. I took myself very seriously and was very careless about my health. And I'll just run through the drive-through and get something quick for 69 cents. You know, cheap and fast.
Right.
And
right.
Just, I got things to do. I don't have time to chop up a salad. And no, you don't have time not to chop up a salad. If you don't have your health, it's really hard to have much of anything else. You have to have some degree of being physically functional before you can pursue your dreams. I'm not saying you have to be in primo health, because there's some amazing people who, like Stephen Hawking, who have done things in a wheelchair. So it's not all over if you don't have your health, but it certainly makes it a lot more difficult to live life fully. And the parts that we have to be responsible for, the choices that we make every day, they do make a difference. You can make a difference in your own life. We don't just have to accept, okay, I'm sick, I'm always going to feel terrible, I'm just going to be on drugs for the rest of my life. We don't have to accept that kind of bad news. We can make things better. How much better? I don't know. Let's find out. Let's give it a try and find out how much better.
Very true. Where can someone go to buy your book and get more information about you and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, the big catch-all is thesingingpatient.com. Everything there. I've got videos, songs, where you can get the book, where the shows I'm doing, all everything's there. Pictures of me and my slippers, all there at thesingingpatient.com.
Wonderful. Do sick people that you perform for relate better to you than those who are healthy?
Yes. Well, it depends. I've learned what to do is to tailor my material. If the show is just billed as Carla Ulbrich, Professional Smart Aleck, then I know it's for the general – that's my other moniker. It's for the general public, and they're not expecting a bunch of medical humor. So for them, I have learned the hard way that it's a three-song limit with the medical stuff. As soon as I go to four songs, you feel them turning on you. But if I'm going to lupus convention or an MS support group and I'm performing for them, then I can do the entire program with medical humor and they don't bat an eye and they love it and they're like, oh, you're singing about me. Thank heaven someone's finally singing about me. So I've learned how to shift the focus. So for earth people, as I call them, earth people who haven't been through anything serious, health problems, or haven't had a loved one who's been through anything that challenging health-wise, I just stick to three songs and a few jokes about the medical stuff, and then we get right back to singing about Klingons and wedgies and Waffle House and dating and grocery shopping and that sort of thing. But for the groups where I can, who are people, the majority of the people there have been through something serious, they're ready for a whole hour or hour and a half of nothing but medical topics. So I have, in that way, the freedom to just completely air it out with those groups.
Interesting. You write about the importance of humor in healing. Can humor also be hurtful in some ways?
Oh, sure. If anybody who's been to public school out on the playground knows that humor can be very mean, which is why we come up with those little retort, sticks and stones may hurt my bones, but words will never hurt me. Well, that's not true. Words can hurt you.
Right.
Humor needs to be not aimed at the person who's already in pain. That's why I suggest things like if you don't know what appropriate thing to make a joke about, certainly don't aim it at the person who's in pain, you know, making jokes about their ailments. And they always say that there's an old joke, and I don't even remember who said it, but if you have major surgery, that's comedy. If I have a hangnail, that's tragedy. Meaning, if it's happening to someone else, it's funny.
Right.
Like the Roadrunner and the Wile E. Coyote, you know, he's always getting hurt, and some people think that's just hilarious to watch him always constantly falling on his face and getting squashed by a giant weight. But but when it's happening to you, not so funny. So I like to say the funny, not funny, you know, you making fun of my illness, not funny. Me making fun of my illness, funny. So So if you want to bring humor to someone who's sick, you know, first you ask permission, you know, would you like some funny books? Would you like some funny DVDs? What do you like? Do you want to hear a joke? You kind of stick a toe in the water. That way it keeps you from making things worse. That's kind of my thing with trying to make humor therapeutic. I actually belong to the Association for Applied and Therapeutic Humor.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to put the word therapeutic in there to distinguish that humor can be non-therapeutic. In case anyone's forgotten their playground experiences or your yo mama jokes.
Right.
It can be mean.
Very interesting. How has this chapter in your life changed you?
Well, I'm not Michigan J. Frog anymore. I don't hide my light under a bushel. I don't run from the stage anymore, and it's broken me completely out of my shell. And I'm completely authentic now. I'm living my best life. I'm pursuing my dreams. And I have perspective. I'm not as upset or afraid of things as I used to be, because I've faced some pretty painful and challenging and scary things. So it makes things like getting stuck in traffic, just turn on the radio, you know. Not sitting there laying on the horn going, out of my way.
Right.
Not that I really did that before, but I live in New Jersey and I see a lot of it. But yeah, I don't have stage fright anymore. I do what I feel like I was put here on earth to do, instead of just taking the first thing that comes along. Okay, I'll work in retail. I don't even like retail, but I'm afraid to do what I really want to do, so I'll do this, you know. And I've put a lot more value on my health and personal responsibility. I'm much more taking responsibility for how each day goes and how my life goes, instead of being a victim.
Mm-hmm.
So if you decide I'm not going to be a victim of lupus, I'm also not going to be a victim of life. Make my choices and be proactive about what happens with my life. Make plans. Be flexible, but make plans and make choices. Make conscious, deliberate choices.
That's fantastic.
Course, yeah, thank you. And of course, you know, keep the laughter in there every day.
Yeah, that's fantastic. You kind of went in within yourself and took a journey inward. And that's fascinating.
These things, you know, whether it's a divorce or an illness or a horrible car accident or, you know, just any kind of loss, they are an opportunity. It doesn't feel like an opportunity when it happens, but it can become an opportunity to become more you, more. It is a growth opportunity. Nobody likes a growth opportunity when it happens. But if you take the growth out, you know, it's just painful. It's not fun. But it is an opportunity to become stronger. The old cliche, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And going through the process, maybe not so fun, but being stronger is fun.
Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Certainly. Okay, first of all, everything our grandparents told us, totally true. Eat your vegetables, get enough sleep, go outside, get fresh air, and exercise. All that stuff they told us is obvious, but we have to be reminded. But the other things are, and our grandparents weren't so big on this, do something you love every day. If you can't have a job that you love, then have a hobby that you love. Have friends who you love being around. Gratitude, very, very important. I like to every day make a gratitude list, at least three things, but I usually get carried away and write for a couple of pages of everything I'm grateful for. And when you're in the doldrums and everything just seems like it stinks, sometimes you have to reach really, really far to find anything you're grateful for. Ooh, I was able to digest my lunch today. And then once you think of one, you're able to think of another one. Oh, somebody was nice to me today. And then next thing you know, you're like, hey, I have hair. I didn't always have hair. And then you just get carried away, and there's two or three pages of everything you're grateful for. For me now, it's just so easy, but at first it was a struggle, and it's such a great way to turn around how you feel. And then number one, vitamin F, I call it, which is fun and friendship. And they found that if you do something like a big barbecue with a bunch of friends who you really like hanging out with, it boost your immune system for 3 days afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And then they did another study that found out if you have something like that coming up,
mm-hmm.
then it boosts your immune system for 3 days before because you're looking forward to it.
Right.
So you got to do something fun once a week, and you'll keep your immune system optimized for perfect.
That's fantastic. That's wonderful. Carla, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be novelist Joseph Lunivis. Joseph began writing at the age of 16 and has won a number of literary awards even before publishing his first book. Joseph and I will be discussing about his life's journey and his new novel titled Open Wounds. For additional information about this show, future shows, and to receive a free recipe for living, please come to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Carla, thank you again, and have a great day. It was a pleasure having you.
Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.